This is the Muscles and Management Podcast, where we build your body and your business. Talking all things training, sports performance, and business for athletes and aspiring coaches to enhance your training and better your career. Muscles and Management is brought to you by Challenger Strength with your host, Jerry DeFilippo.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 57 of the Muscles and Management Podcast. As always, please leave a rating, review, and definitely subscribe. You guys are going to want updates on the coming episodes because we have some very cool stuff coming up. And subscribing is a good way to make sure that you're up to date on everything Muscles and Management. I can't stress this enough. Well, I don't want to make it sound that dramatic, but like the reviews and ratings, as I always say, definitely go a long way. So, if you can do that, if you haven't yet, that'd be huge. Thank you, as always. Talking about some of our previous episodes this past week, we had episode 56, Zan Barksdale, episode 55 the week before, Rob Hill and Eric Jaegers. That is literally shattering my pace for downloads. It's easy to see why. They're just two very intelligent guys. Honestly, like episode 56, 55 and 54, I had Zan, Rob and Eric, and then I had Eric Osberg on episode 54. Between having one guy that's, currently in a big league, on a big league affiliate team, who's also very passionate about training, two guys that are pitching coordinators at the major league level, and then a guy like Zan who, played Division I baseball at Ole Miss, has experience coaching with Team USA, and just overall, there's a lot of really cool stuff when it comes to baseball, catching training, strength training, things like that. Like three episodes in a row that you can just get a lot out of on all different topics because they're all very different from each other, which I think is awesome. They're very diverse. So check those out, 56, 55, and 54. If you haven't yet, promise you guys you will not be disappointed. Those guys all brought it. Coming soon, I actually just wrapped up an interview with Eric Sim last week, and he was fantastic. I will just give you a little bit of a kind of quote unquote warning slash preemptive kind of talk on this episode. It's like very locker room esque. Like it's two guys just sitting down, like talking about a lot of important stuff, but like, no punches are being held. It's not like vulgar or anything, but like, we're quote unquote shooting the shit and just talking, and some F bombs are dropped. But I just want to make anyone aware, if you have any kids that may listen to the show with you, just if you're okay with it, it's fine. But it's a little more colorful than usual. But nonetheless, very, very good to learn from. Eric is a guy that, played up into the AAA level, started out his baseball career and his life in South Korea, came to Canada as a 13-year-old, made his way to junior college in Kansas. And that was his first time being in the States. Transferred to University of South Florida, tremendous program, had a bunch of Division I four-year program offers after his two-year stint at junior college. So we're going to talk a little bit about that, process and, what JUCO is and the benefits of it and, why people don't really understand or really give it the respect that it deserves and, why it's a good route to go if you're not really sure of yourself. So we're going through Eric's whole life. He's been through a lot and he's seen a lot and he's done a lot to develop himself as a player and now as in his post career. We're talking a little bit, how he got to that point and then also a little bit about, the last couple years for him getting back into, throwing and hitting again since it's been 2 years since he stopped playing. He hadn't really touched it and he's built himself up to a 90 plus mile an hour fastball again. He squats over 500 pounds. He benches 330. Like we're talking about his training now. What has changed in the game? What's going on going forward in the game? And it all has like a really authentic feel to it. Just like two guys kind of having a beer and talking and, reminiscing and talking about some cool stuff, in like a nice locker room setting. So that's going to be a little bit different than what you guys are used to, but definitely a lot, of good reasons to check that out. I'm also working on Dr. Greg Rose of, On Base U and my TPI. That'll be huge. Excited to have him come on and I will give you guys more news as I work out that schedule. I also just talked to Bobby Stroop and Bob Alejo, two really smart guys in the field. This is yesterday, actually. I'm recording this on a Sunday. So this was Saturday. I reached out to them and I'm working on getting them scheduled. I was supposed to have Chidi and you come on this weekend, but a couple things popped up with both of our schedules. We weren't able to make it work, but I'm working on him for this week. And then, of course, Julian, as I've been mentioning. So a lot of fun stuff coming up. So make sure you stay subscribed and don't miss. Before I get into this week's episode, just kind of like a little bit of a tweet slash topic rant of the week. Basically, I tweeted about this, the topic that strength training isn't an avenue to directly develop sports skill. And don't worry, I'm not going to get on a 20-minute monologue here because I was admonished for that recently. But I think we get too caught up sometimes in trying to or thinking that we can directly work on a sports skill in the area or the realm of strength training. And I think that the pitfalls of that end up being that we ignore the foundational principles or the things we need to kind of get started with training and get us stronger and get us faster. And instead, we look to make things too similar to sport movements or things going on in sports, particularly themselves, versus looking at strength training as a way to enhance strength, motor skill, speed, etc., that will enhance sports skill. So you're not directly developing sports skill, you're enhancing it. So I'm very passionate about that. I think it's something that we need to just keep talking about because, you know, people definitely, you know, have a little bit of the wrong idea about that from some of the stuff that's out there with, you know, strength training being, you know, resisted bats and balls. And I just put up a tweet a little while ago about, you know, someone trying to react to different color changing lights on the ground and people pushing back on me that like, it's good for this, it's good for that. I'm like, that's not my point. My point is that like, it's put out there that people think that's like what they need to do instead of strength training or instead of sprinting or instead of doing, you know, things with their actual sport. Like, I'm burping a lot. Get the actual soccer ball on the field and do drills with that. You know, get a football, get a basketball, whatever it is, and then play your sport and then do your strength training. Like, it's just, it's not that hard and it's something we seem to make really hard. So it's definitely something I'm passionate about and I'm not going to shut up about it. I'm going to keep talking about it. So, say no more on that. I was going to give a bio on Mike Boyle, who obviously, as you know, is this week's guest, but I think his name and his resume and, you know, his reputation kind of speak for themselves, man. This guy's been coaching for 40 years. That's 15 more years than I've been alive. So I was kind of like really stoked to just sit and talk with him. But I think this is one of the cooler episodes that I've done because we're talking a lot about training specifically and things like that, but we also get a lot into the business end of sports strength and conditioning, whether you're, you know, trying to get into the field as a school coach or, you know, to have a business that you want to run or whatever it is. And we're talking a lot about getting into the field, what that involves, some of the misconceptions around that, you know, marketing versus publicity and Mike's opinion on that. He's a really good quote about the differences between those two things and some of the things you need to really want, you really want to do if you're a young coach who wants to get in the industry or any coach that wants to get in the industry. And then we kind of wrap things up talking a little bit about, you know, speed training, in-season training, research versus anecdotal evidence and like what we're actually doing, you know, applied with athletes and stuff like that. So I don't think a bio is needed. Mike's name and reputation speak for themselves and he was fantastic. I know you guys are going to love this one. You know, take that notebook out or your phone or whatever you write notes on and just, you know, trying to get down some of the stuff because it's really good and it could help, you know, whether you're an athlete, coach, parent, there's just a lot of knowledge in there for anybody. So I hope you guys enjoy this. Mike was fantastic as always. Until next time. Peace. All right, everyone. I'd like to welcome on Mike Boyle. Coach, thanks so much for your time. Excited to have you.
Thanks for having me. I love doing these. I'm actually trying to do one a week if I can with people because I get a lot of requests for it and I really do enjoy it. I think one of the things you need to do in this sort of internet world is keep up with the times. And podcasting is clearly where the it's the modern day reading. You know, people don't read like they used to, but they listen. So the ability to get on a lot of these podcasts actually is great in terms of helping to get people good information.
Absolutely. I can even say personally that, you know, even as a host, I learn something every time I record an episode. I've been, you know, blessed to have some awesome guests, you know, in strength conditioning, sports performance, you know, some sport coaches specifically. It's a new learning opportunity, you know, for me every time I have someone on. And obviously, you know, someone like you, you know, who I look up to a lot in terms of the industry and as a young strength coach, I'm, you know, thrilled to have you. And I'm sure a lot of my listeners are going to be pumped to listen to this. So, before we get, you know, kind of into, I, as I told you and as my listeners are pretty used to, I like to go through, you know, tweets of my guests who are active on Twitter. But there were two, you know, important things that I wanted to talk to you about that aren't really super related to the, you know, programming ins and outs and training part of, you know, strength and conditioning, more to the field itself and, you know, maybe more of the professional side of things. What I kind of wanted to ask your opinion on to start off was I've seen you talk a little bit about it and, you know, in terms of the strength conditioning field and, you know, how we're perceived to outsiders and, you know, some of the pitfalls of being too, you know, energy driven and kind of gimmicky and with the yelling and screaming and, you know, kind of how we present ourselves to outsiders. So I wanted to get your kind of take on that and, you know, what that fine line is between passion and, you know, keeping professionalism.
Well, it's, I get myself in trouble with these things, but I'm old one. I'm 60 years old, doing this for almost 40 years. And to be truthful, some days I'm embarrassed to tell people what I do because we're clowns. We are the circus jesters, particularly of the football world in terms of dancing and, you know, making fools of ourselves on the sidelines in order to have a job or get a job. So I think we've got a huge professionalism problem right now in the industry, because people are being rewarded for being clowns. They're being rewarded for wearing clothes that don't fit or for dancing or, and it's, to me, it's absolutely positively absurd. And as I said, it's embarrassing. Sometimes people are like, oh, you're one of those guys that, you know, what size clothes do you wear? You know, how good a dancer are you? And I think I'm a really good strength and conditioning coach. I'm a terrible dancer and I generally wear clothes that fit, but that's the perception. Or we're the get back guy. You know, do you have a guy that you hold? You know, you have to hold him around the waist to keep him from running on the field. These are all the things that people think that we do.
Yeah.
And then, but we feed into this ourselves because there's so much ego in our profession. There's so many guys who got into it because they like to lift weights and they're into how they look. And then they see that all the other bullshit sells. The yelling and the screaming and the dancing and the clothing and all that stuff. So it just sort of fuels the fire for a lot of these people, I think, who were probably going in that direction anyway.
Yeah, I think so. I talked to Kurt Hester about this a little bit when he came on the show, and you know, he's in you know, specifically related to football. And you mentioned football as something that, you know, it's a sport that has a big problem with this. I think the biggest thing is, like you mentioned, you know, it's embarrassing sometimes to like be associated with that. And I think it takes away a little bit from, you know, like you said, you answered that question. Like, I'm a good strength and conditioning coach. Like it takes away from some of the knowledge and some of the really smart people that are in the field, and it diminishes them. I think personally.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you. I think, and I always say to people, if you looked at the people that I look up to, the Johnny Parkers of the world, the Alvin Mealers, the Mike Woysicks, the guys, the original football guys, the original NFL guys, none of these guys. These guys were professionals. Not only were they professionals, they were nice people. They were good quality people. They were teachers. They were coaches. We're moving in such a negative direction right now that, as I said, it's embarrassing is the only word I can use. I see the videos sometimes because the videos obviously make the rounds on Twitter fairly quickly. And the bad part is some of these guys might be good strength coaches. I've had people come back at me and defend them. This guy's a great strength coach. His guys love him. And I'm not saying he's a bad strength coach. I'm not saying that his guys don't like him. I'm saying he's an embarrassing clown.
Yeah.
And those are different things. So you could be a good strength coach and your players could love you and you could still be an embarrassment to the profession. And I think there are people that are. And so that's – obviously, I'm not going to win friends doing this stuff, but that's the advantage of being 60 and owning your own business.
Once
my kids still talk to me and my wife still talks to me and the dogs still love me when I come home, I really don't care.
Yeah, so, no, I agree. Yeah.
Whereas Kurt's a lot younger. He's just insane. So he's totally different.
So it's interesting to me. It feels like two things. One, it feels like people equate good coaches with that type of behavior in terms of you need to be doing that stuff. Like you have to have quote unquote high energy. Kurt actually mentioned a story, you know, the coaches get on the bus after the game that the team lost. And it's like, you know, we lost because we didn't have energy today. And it's like, well, maybe you were just out coached or the scheme wasn't right. Or, you know, I'm talking about like he was mentioning the football specifics of things, but like it even goes to the weight room. Like, oh, if we're going to get better or we're going to get stronger, faster, whatever it is, or, you know, reduce injury, we have to bring the intensity every day and there's yelling and screaming. It's like, no, like maybe just have a good program and make sure that the, you know, athletes know what's expected of them. And, you know, there's all those boxes are checked off and it's maybe not so much about the energy. I mean, you need energy, but like it's the right energy.
Right. Well, it's different because I said in the hockey world, hockey is not an energy sport in terms of in the pregame.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of phony bullshit. There's not a lot of guys headbutting, running around. And then they just go out and smash into each other at 20 miles an hour and get their teeth knocked out. And
it's pretty crazy. Yeah.
And so when you've been in the hockey world, I think sometimes you can look at the football world and think there's a lot of fake energy, a lot of false enthusiasm. Let's manufacture some enthusiasm here to make it look like we're doing our job. The good thing, I always go back to Chris Doyle. Chris Doyle is the highest paid guy in strength and conditioning at Iowa. And I was lucky enough to be Chris's college strength coach. We've been friends for, again, probably going on 30 years, maybe more than 30 years, actually. And he is not a clown. He is a professional guy. His staff are professional guys. The guys that he puts out, and he's put out more strength and conditioning coaches probably in the last 20 years than anybody in the industry. Professional guys. And I think the difference is there are guys willing to sell out. There are guys willing to be the energy guy. And there are some guys, like I said, it may be that if that's your personality, okay, I'd have to live with that. I might have a guy on my staff. He was a great coach and that was his personality. I'd probably just try to rein that guy in just enough. Say, okay, your clothes have to fit. You're not going to be freaking break dancing on the sidelines, but I don't mind you getting jacked up and, you know, you can be chest bumping guys and running around. That's okay. I don't think that that's the end of the world. The problem is I believe there's a lot of that now that is manufactured for media, for social media, for television, to make guys look the part. And even Kurt alluded to it. I'll plug Kurt's book while I'm here, Rants of a Strength and Conditioning Madman. If you're in the strength and conditioning field and you haven't read it, you're missing out. Get the book and read it. It's hysterical, but it's hysterical and true both at the same time, which is really, really good. But you got to kind of be who you are. And even as he said, he did some crazy stuff when he was a kid.
Yeah.
When he was younger in the field.
He even says that when we spoke, he said like, hey, like I'm a nut. Like I'm insane. But like, it's not on video. It's not getting promoted. Like I'm not running up and down the sidelines when the cameras are on. It's like, I'm doing it because it's real and it's behind closed doors and I'm not doing it to be seen because obviously no one's seeing it, just me and the guys.
Right. And that's what I think that's become the biggest difference. Although I'm still not an advocate of some of those things.
Yeah.
I can deal with them more when I don't feel like it's manufactured.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of it right now is manufactured.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. It's like, it's, you know, hey, we're on the sidelines, you know, it's 30 degrees outside. I remember the one coach was like sleeveless in 30 degree weather on the sidelines. And it's like, you know, you're on, you know, the college football in the morning on Saturdays being shown, not the players. And the players are who it's about. So I think that was something Kurt said to me too that kind of resonated. It was, you know, at the end of the day, you know, the players are the focus. They're the ones that should be getting the attention and the team should be getting the attention and not the strength coach. It's like, you know, we've gotten into this field because we understand the fact that, like, you know, we're the guys behind the scenes, you know, making the athletes or helping them to get, you know, bigger, stronger, stay healthy and all those things and not the ones getting, you know, all the limelight and the attention. So I think, you know, you hit the nail on the head with it just like he did. And I guess my other, you know, two questions just to finish off in this topic would be, you know, why do you think it's so important to make sure that we're drawing attention to ourselves in a positive light when it comes to, you know, the perception of the sport coaches and rehabilitation professionals specifically? Like, you know, we need to be taken seriously in terms of our interactions with them. And then I guess my last part would be like, you know, any advice to young coaches or coaches in general when it comes to, you know, handling this part of what we do?
Well, one, second part first. Advice to young coaches, wear clothes to fit and don't be a freaking clown. That would be my advice to young coaches. And, I mean, you know, again, people will sell out in every field, and they're doing it in ours. And if that's who you are, if you want to be a sellout and be a phony energy guy and, you know, sing and dance, and you should have gone off with cheerleading, okay? You shouldn't be a strength and conditioning coach.
Yeah.
So you could be on the sidelines and do cartwheels and backflips and cheers, and everybody would expect that from you. I don't expect that from you. And, again, I would never hire somebody – and or assist somebody in getting a job who I knew was that kind of coach. But again, that's just me. So that would be in the advice column because, again, like you said, we're support staff. We should be supporting. We should not be trying to get on ESPN or trying to become a Twitter hero. But the problem, and you said why, as I said, it is the ego. It's the insecurity of the weightlifter. I had one of my friends when we first started doing this back in the 1970s. He was a pretty good powerlifter, Olympic lifter, small kid. was like a 132 pounder. And he'd always look at me and go, Mike, weights, guns, karate, and cars. He said, you'll find all the insecure people doing one of those things, sometimes all four. he said, you'll know a really insecure guy because he lifts weights, does karate, has a gun, and a sports car. And I just laughed. I was like, you're so right.
Yeah.
And the problem is we get those types of people who go into the profession. And if you come in insecure, you're probably not going to get more secure as you try to move your way up the ladder. And that, I think, will affect your ability to really be a true professional.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it just it clouds the important stuff of what we do and kind of just gets in the way. I think that's well said and a good way to leave off on that. Another thing. Go ahead.
We won the national championship in 1995.
Okay.
I still Providence Civic Center. We had lost, I think, three championship games leading up to that in the 90s. We'd been in the championship game either two or three times leading up to that. I didn't even go on the ice. I walked out of the rink. I was sitting in a seat. I was never a guy that was on the bench during a hockey game because I always had other teams to deal with. So I wasn't, although I was sort of a dedicated hockey guy, I stayed in the weight room until 7 o'clock when the game started and then ran across and watched the game. I didn't need to be in the locker room on the bench, that kind of stuff. And when we won, I walked out of the concourse by myself and I just sat down. It's like, wow, this is really cool. We did it. I never even went on the ice, never went down. And then probably whatever, 15, 20 minutes later, I made my way down to the locker room to see the guys. And I think that's, you have to be comfortable with yourself. I knew I had a huge part in that national championship. And I didn't need to figure out, hey, am I going to get on TV? Will I get in the picture? I never, team pictures. You couldn't find a team picture probably past the early 80s that I ever got in. The coach would be like, oh, we're doing team pictures. I'm like, yeah, I'm busy. Yeah, that stuff never mattered to me. I think that's good.
Yeah, I think like you said, you know you had a big part in it and you were secure. You know, you mentioned insecurities. You were secure in the fact that you knew that and you knew that like that was obvious because of just the body of work and the position the athletes were in physically and they knew it and the coaches knew it. It's like, you didn't have that insecurity because you knew you did your job and that was it. So it's a good story, I think, to kind of wrap up that, part of like what I wanted to talk to you about. It says it all. Like you knew what you did and it was effective and say no more. That was it.
That's it. And it is. That's all. I mean, you need to have that attitude. I think you need to believe in yourself.
Yeah, for sure. I guess if your listeners, the coaches, especially that are listeners, take that piece and write it down. In terms of, and speaking again, like I being a young strength coach, I kind of sometimes frame a lot of these questions because like it's almost like like I said before, I'm learning from you as I talk to you. But a little bit about, and again, something you've tweeted about, and I don't really ever get involved in these discussions on Twitter because I don't feel like my perspective of since I'm such a young coach, I haven't really I don't think it's my perspective is valuable in terms of like the whole dues concept thing. And do you think too much of the industry or coaches trying to enter the industry, they have a faulty perception of like how quick or easy it should be or to make an impact, land a good position? There are some guys that are young and have been able to, like I tell people all the time, don't use me as an example. Like I had a couple good opportunities and basically caught lightning in a bottle with what I was doing and it took off. But it's hard to get going and get traction. I think some people definitely get the idea that it's a little easier than it should be.
I think that's, and I hate to say it, I hate to pick on millennials, but I think that's kind of a millennial thing in general. So it's really interesting. I keep in my computer, I just pulled it up. Bill Gates spoke at a high school graduation and talked about 11 things you won't learn in school. The first one was life isn't fair, get used to it. Two, the world won't care about your self-esteem. The world will expect you to accomplish something before you feel good about yourself. Three, you will not make $40,000 a year right out of high school. You won't be a vice president with a car phone until you earn both. Rule four, if you think your teacher's tough, wait till you get a boss. He doesn't have tenure. And he goes on and on, but it's basically the idea is that kids today are entitled. And when kids get into strength and conditioning, they're entitled because they think that, again, that everything should be easier than it is. And I've gotten involved in the internship. Internships should be paid. And I look at it and think, why should I, in my business, why should I pay someone who wants to come and intern with me? Someone's asking to work and to learn. We're going to teach them everything that we know about our system, give them as much information as they could possibly digest during their internship, and I should pay them to do that. I think that, to me, is completely absurd.
Yeah.
These are the things. So, yes, I think there is absolutely no question that young people coming into the profession, I have people think, you know, I'm 30, I haven't made it yet. You know, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I'm like, I didn't have a full-time job. I didn't have health insurance until I was 30. And so, and people look at me, oh, but you, people say, oh, it's easier for you because you're a Mike Boyle.
And I'm like, you aren't always,
right. Well, I always was. I didn't ever change my name.
Well, yeah, but your name, but, yeah, but like who you are, how you're recognized, you had to build that.
Right, exactly. And that's that was my whole point, is that, yeah, of course, I mean, it's easy for me now, but it wasn't. I had two jobs till I was 52 years old. That was when I was 52 was the first time I was not holding two simultaneously full-time jobs. And people just don't get that. And they, well, why are you successful? Well, I'm right, because I was working until I was 52 years old, doing two full-time jobs, in addition to writing and speaking and doing all the other things that I was doing. So I get a little bit bent when people, when we get into any of that. I would say whenever we are interviewing somebody, if anyone talks to me about benefits or moving on or going to the next level or whatever, I just immediately, like, I'm like, oh, we're done.
Yeah.
I don't say it, but I just know in my head we're done. Okay. If you don't, if what you're worried about is what's next or what you're worried about is, I had a guy come in one time and ask me about, you know, I live kind of far away. Would I get a gas allowance? I didn't tell you where to live.
Yeah.
You can live where you want. You can move next door.
Or go pick another gym to intern at. Like, it's not, you want to come here. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it's unbelievable the things that kids will ask. I mean, I've had kids come in sneakers and sweatpants. And, you know, started asking, I mean, again, when kids ask about, you know, what about vacation days? What about sick days? I'm like, we don't take vacation and we don't get sick. So if you feel like you're going to need a vacation or you're going to be sick, this is probably not the place for you.
Yeah.
Because I love what I do. I used to vacation when I was at Boston University. I would go the week between Christmas and New Year's, and that was the only time I took off all year. It would drive my wife crazy. I wouldn't take a week off in the summer. I'm like, we can't take a week off in the summer. Summer's off-season training. Like, it's our most important time. I'm just going to disappear for a week? I can't do that.
Yeah.
And God bless my wife, God Almighty. I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing that she's still here, or I'm still here, one of us, because I was not an easy person to get along with.
Yeah, it's a tough, like, you'll get into this field, you should at least, expecting, embracing, like, I honestly, and I'm not even just saying this when I tell you this, like, I look forward to, like, that. And this is something I want to get to as well, because I feel like sometimes people, and I have a good memory, I've seen you talk about this on Twitter, people make it, like, kind of seem like you have to work, you know, 19 hours a day to be successful, and, like, not sleep and whatever, and that a whole agenda is pushed, which is a different side of the spectrum. But I will say, in just a sense of, like, you have to be able to embrace, like, the fact that you're going to have to work some, you know, long hours, and you're going to have to be kind of, the sweat equity has to be put in, and you need to, you know, earn your keep, so to speak. You have to learn and, you know, not get paid at first. And I think that's a big part of it. And people need to understand that.
Right. I mean, it is it. It's the nature of our field. And I advocate the other way. I always tell people, you don't need to work 12 hours a day.
Yeah. I remember. That's what I'm saying. I've seen you say that.
And I don't think you do. But the difference was I used to work more than 12. I'd work 16 some days. And if you talk to guys like Kurt, because sometimes when things are moving in a great direction and you're getting opportunities, take them.
Yeah. Figure out how you're going to make time for them. Yeah.
And my thing, the reason I was working so much, because I wasn't getting paid. Yeah. I was a college strength and conditioning coach, making probably, when I started, low 20s. Mm-hmm. You. And then the Bruins offered me $10,000 to be their kind of part-time strength and conditioning coach. But I threw myself into the Bruins job, like, hey, wait, this is my other full-time job. I'm going to be here every second I can be here that I'm not at BU coaching. I'm going to be at the Bruins coaching because I want to do a really good job, because I want to make, you know, you want to make something of yourself. That's the difference. I never negotiated ever.
Yeah.
I never negotiated a benefit. I never negotiated. I didn't. And I mean, some people would look and think, oh, you screwed yourself. Well, the end result is I didn't get screwed. The end result is I'm doing okay.
Yeah.
But I think you just, it's about, if you're not in this, like I never even thought about it as a job. I think I bartended till I was 30. So that would have probably been 8 or 9 years. I worked every weekend, Friday, Saturday night, and sometimes Friday night, Saturday night, Saturday day, Sunday day. When I was working over, I was working by Fenway Park right across the street. And during baseball season, you could make a lot of money working Friday night,
yeah.
Saturday night, Sunday day. We could make $400.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Which at that time, you're talking 1980s. That was a massive amount of money. I mean, I bought a house. I bought a car. But I was a strength coach for free.
Yeah.
And I never thought about it. I thought, I got the greatest job in the world. I'm at Boston University. I'm at one of the biggest schools in Boston. And I'm the strength coach there.
Yeah. It's prestigious. It's like, and it's not even like you want to just do something. And that's another thing to be wary of too, is don't do things because of, as the kids would say these days, and I'm one of them, the quote unquote clout. Like, you want to do it for, you know, with the recognition, or it looks good, or whatever it is. Like, you were looking at yourself saying, hey, I'm at Boston University. This is amazing. Like, I'm lucky to be here, and I got to do the, you know, what I can to make the most of it and do the jobs I have to do maybe on the side to make it work because I'm not getting paid, right? Like, you weren't getting anything, and you needed to make it work somehow because you knew that's what you wanted to do.
Yeah. I mean, and I was so excited. I mean, I was happy to be there. Same thing when I worked for the Bruins. I never thought about the amount of money. I was like, I'm at the Bruins game.
Yeah.
I'm in the locker room with Ray Bourque, with Cam Neely, with Hall of Fame guys. And you think about the guys that came through that place, Rick Tocchet, Ally Afraidy, Kevin Stevens. I mean, you know, my friends, the guys that I know are a literal who's who of the hockey world because of the job that I had at that time. But, you know, it was just like, to me, it was amazing that I was even there. And
yeah. Yeah.
You know, I could walk in and out of the garden whenever I wanted to. I could, you know, I was living the life. And the fact that the money stunk it never really even registered with me. That's why it's funny. We were talking about in sports, that's what happens. Now, everybody always bitches about the contracts and the young guys make too much money and this guy's making too much money and this guy's overpaid. And now we're at that in strength and conditioning. People are complaining, oh, so-and-so gets paid $700,000, you know, Chris Doyle gets $700,000 a year. I'm like, good. I hope he makes a million.
Yeah. Yep. why are we like pulling each other down in that sense?
Rising tide raises all boats,
yes,
right?
Yes. Yep.
You know,
market
when
value.
Chris makes a million, that means somebody else is going to make $900,000.
Yeah. Or maybe it raises the $35,000 a year entry job to 50.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. It all goes up.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So you mentioned, you know, and I alluded to this before and you kind of got into it. I said, you know, I've seen you be a guy that doesn't advocate, like you advocate for the opposite of, like, you know, not needing to work 14 hours a day. My question to you, and you mentioned how, like, you were doing that and I've been there too, but it was more because, like, you didn't feel like you had to. You did it because, you know, you were enjoying what you were doing. Opportunities were coming up and you just, like, you know, took on everything you could and just made it work. But I think sometimes people get too caught up in, especially with social media, and that's kind of the crux of a lot of the issues that we're talking about. It's kind of a lot of the cause of it. Working those hours to, like, feel like you did something good. Like, what I'm getting at is the quality of what you're doing and the intent behind it is more important than, like, oh, I worked 16 hours today. Like, I'm grinding. I'm going to get, like, it's just ridiculous when I see people do it for that reason. And I guess you would probably agree with this. Like, that's the one time where if you're going to work hours like that, that's definitely not the reason why you want to do it.
Right, exactly. That's I look at exactly that in terms of it's not the reason why you want to do it. You want to, if you're doing it because either you're enjoying it or it needs to be done or whatever it is. I think, again, it's very. I think that's a part of the football mentality too. Is the football coaches always love that? Oh, you know, they sleep in the off the bed. The great guys sleep in the office, kind of thing. And so the strength coaches, I have these guys say, well, we beat the football guys in. You know, if the football staff's coming in at 5, we're coming in at 4:45. I knew a guy whose name I will leave unmentioned who used to make the staff work out at 4:45 because we want our cars to be in the parking lot before a single football coach shows up. That's stupid. I look at that and think that's absolutely stupid. Yeah. I think you get there when you need to get there. You do what you need to do and you leave. I never liked the job. Whenever I had a job setting where people made me stay around when there was no work, it drove me crazy. It's like, if the work is done, go home. Whatever. Be with your wife, your kids, significant other, whatever you got, go do that. And I'm a huge advocate of that now, even with the people that work for me. We have no hours mandate at all. You can work as much or as little as you want. And I don't worry about it. People that want to put in a lot of hours will put in a lot of hours. People that don't won't. And it's fine. I don't care. As long as you do your job, as long as what you're supposed to do when you're there gets done, that's great. So the hours thing, I think, is another one of the sort of insecure badges of courage that people wear around and brag about, as you said, the grind and the hours and all that BS. I did it. So again, it's interesting that I advocate against it. But I remember I had assistants that I told don't open in the morning, because what I did when I was at BU, I opened at 12 and I closed at 7. I said, because I'm not going to be here all day. I'm not opening at 6 and closing at 6. That's stupid. That means I stay here for 12 hours and the kids come whenever they want. I scheduled it from 12 to 7.
Yeah.
And that was the way the weight room opens at 12, it closes at 7. People said, what about in the morning? I'm not here in the morning.
Yeah.
And I'd work at the Bruins in the morning so I could have another job and make more of the type of living that I wanted to make from a financial standpoint. I think the difference is when you compromise your time and you don't get compensated financially, that's when you're stupid. If you're getting compensated, I always had two jobs. I was always getting two salaries. So I was fine with it. I worked hard in the summer and I'd run my summer camps in the summer and I'd make more money in the summer. I was a business person, I think, before it was fashionable to be a business person. And I approached it in a business-like manner in terms of, I'm going to get paid when I work.
Yeah.
I'd work Saturday and Sunday. I had a friend of mine who ran hockey camps and he said, I'll pay you. I think he was paying me then, which was a lot of money. $30 or $40 an hour to talk to the kids. He said, you know, I'm going to run six groups today. I want you to talk to six groups of middle school kids, basically, about off-ice training. And we'd run these little kind of lecture demo sort of things in the weight room. And I'd make $150 for the day.
Yeah.
And at that time, I mean, that was huge money to get paid. You're talking minimum wage was probably $250 an hour or something then. And I was getting $30 or $40 an hour.
It's really good, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, it was big money.
Yeah, let me ask you this though. You made a great point about, you know, working and getting paid when you're working, but you have to get to that point, right? When I first started out, like I literally, and this is something I get DM'd from people, like, hey man, you know you made it up quickly, like you got a nice thing going in a short amount of time, like how'd you do it? And it said, well, you know, my biggest thing was I took some athletes on for free when I first started in terms of like, hey, like. You know I don't really have a resume or, you know, a bunch of results behind me to show you why you should be paying me. So come in for free. Let me train you. And the trade-off for me is that I can, you know, put your results together and I could put your training in. This is, you know, one of the benefits of social media. I could put it on social media, show people what I'm doing. And I did that with a couple athletes, and it really helped me, like, get more traction and get people in my door and build up what I like to call like a portfolio of results, so to speak, that you could like kind of show people, teams, whoever you want to like try to work with, that like, hey, I have a body of work and I know what I'm doing. And I think doing stuff for free is one of the easiest ways you can build that up if possible. Would you agree with that?
That's what I did in the beginning. Yeah. All of my initial pro clients, particularly in football, were free.
Yeah.
I'd have guys, because I was the only strength coach in Boston.
But that opens so many doors, right? Like that helps you get traction.
Yeah. Boston College didn't have a strength coach. I had tons of BC football players that would come over and train with me. And in the beginning, I wasn't charging them because I didn't care. I just wanted to get these guys in the door and get the – and part of it for me too is I want to get the experience training these guys. What's it going to be like to train an elite Division I guy? Because, again, maybe at that time I might have had a little bit of insecurity in terms of, oh, we had mostly one – you know, we were 1AA football, so I wasn't getting the kind of pro prospects that Boston College was getting at that time. But eventually that led to a really good agent relationship for me and to a really good combine training business. I actually get credit, believe it or not, in a book called The Draft for inventing combine training. I don't know if I did, but I know I was one of the first. If I wasn't the first person to ever do it, I was one of the first two. And the guy in the book, this guy Pete Williams, says that I invented combine training in the early 80s.
Yeah. But that, like you wouldn't have been there if it wasn't for, like, I don't know if you know Kyle Bodie with Driveline Baseball. Kyle has said this so many times that his biggest advice to someone is literally partner up with an organization and, like, say, I'll train them for free. Literally just go to a baseball organization, a hockey organization. I trained the Hitmen for virtually nothing when I first started with them, and it was the greatest thing I ever did. It was like the best thing I ever did.
If you're looking to build your reputation, go someplace, volunteer, work for you. That's how I started. I quit my full-time job at Boston University. I was a full-time athletic trainer. I resigned in 1982. I literally walked across the hall. The weight room was across the hall. We had a 600-square-foot weight room, and I set up shop in that weight room. Okay. It's like, I'm here. I'm the strength coach.
Yep.
I had none of the coaches were dealing with me. None of the athletes were dealing with me, and I was just there. And then I still remember I was in there. Rick Pitino was a basketball coach, talking to Rick Pitino about training, and he said, you know, you want to run the program for basketball. We need somebody to run the preseason. It's like, I'm in. He left shortly after that, so I never actually worked for Rick Pitino. Mm-hmm. I forget whether he went to the Knicks or Providence at that time, but he took another job really shortly after that. But the guy that was the assistant, John Kuster, who was a former NBA player, kept the deal, and I trained the basketball players. The hockey coaches saw what I was doing with the basketball players and said, we need this, and we can get you some money to do it. And they got me some money out of their fundraising budget. And then I went and I convinced the football coach, who was a friend of mine from college, or the football line coach at that time, not that he wasn't the head coach, Tim Murphy, who's now been the head coach at Harvard for 20-something years. But I convinced him to let me run the football off-season program. So within the space of about 2 months, I had managed to get football, basketball, and hockey all, you know, the ability to work with all of them. None of it. I was not negotiating any financial deal.
That's the biggest key, what you said, the ability to work with them. Like the number one thing you said there.
I was able to push my foot in the door.
Yep.
And then it's a matter of, okay, if you do a good job, they'll pay you.
Yeah. I mean, you can leverage an experience for lack of pay. Like, go to places that can't afford to, or don't want to, for that matter, to pay someone that's, like, quote unquote, super qualify, and they're more willing to give someone. Like, I literally was a semester. I was in business school, and I got I had certifications and everything, but, like, I was able to get to work with these athletes because I did it for pretty much for free. Like, they were willing to take a flyer on me because they, you know, I was ambitious and they didn't have the money to spend on a quote unquote high level guy. So that's my advice. And I think you hit the nail on the head with the ability to work with athletes. And I think, imagine how much easier you'd agree with this, how much easier it would have been for you, even more so, if you had a social media to post that you were with the exercises you were doing with the teams you were working with for free back then. That's how, like, a lot of people can start to build a following now, is to post some of the stuff you're doing with the free work you're doing and the results you're getting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's totally – the game has changed so much. I was lucky in terms of what happened to me is the newspaper started to pick up on it, because guys would the papers were always looking for stories. And so, okay, we're going to write a story about so-and-so's getting ready for the draft. And then, okay, well, where's he getting ready? Well, he's over at BU training with Mike Boyle. It came to be almost standard. Well, everybody who's training for something is going over to BU and training with Mike Boyle. And eventually people started realizing, well, gee, I should be sending my kids to train with Mike Boyle.
Yep.
And I remember years ago I read a book. A guy named Al Reese wrote a book called The 21 Immutable Laws of Branding. And one of the things that he said was that brands were created by publicity, not by advertising. And that always, in terms of that, he said, advertising is generally perceived to be false or deceptive, whereas publicity is perceived to be true. So anytime any writer, I mean, I've had, you know, TV stations, everything, anytime someone wanted to come, I can remember I've been on ESPN. ESPN wanted to come when I was working with a draft guy, Eric Swan, who ended up going seventh in the draft, was, I think, one of only two or three non-college players ever to be drafted in the first round. And ESPN was like, can we come and film him working out? I'm like, you sure can. And so here I am down in the weight room with Eric Swan. This was probably early 90s with ESPN guys and cameras. And they're getting ready to do a Sports Center segment on this high school kid who's going to be a first round draft pick. But there I am. I'm running the workout. So I'm in every clip. not because I'm trying to be in every clip, but just because of the way the workout's going. And that stuff happened over and over and over again for me to the point where it got almost ridiculous.
Yeah, I think I've never heard that quote before, but like, you know, when you hear something that kind of summarizes how you feel, but you couldn't put it into words, like that's one of those moments for me. Like, I'm going to start using that whenever I get a DM about a question of something about, you know, getting started up or whatever it is. And I also like to say that people view marketing or even, like you said, whether it's publicity or the advertising. And I do agree that publicity is definitely, like, in the way you described it, you know, way better for those reasons. But it's not like, you know, one thing happens and a tidal wave occurs. Like, it's like little drop in the bucket here, little drop in the bucket there. And like, they add up and you keep chipping away. And next thing you know, the bucket spills over. Like, that's how you build a business. Very rarely does it just explode in 1 week. Like, it's people, again, there's, like you said, that entitlement. Like, there's that feeling that it should happen that easily and that quickly. And it's not the case.
Right. Exactly. And it's all the cliches. The tortoise beats the hare. Slow and steady wins the race. We could go on with cliches forever, but it's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
I always say that to people. I'm a 40-year overnight success, because it's amazing how people perceive that suddenly one day you just became famous.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, this, I've been doing this. People are shocked sometimes when I said, I'm doing this. This is my 39th year coaching.
Yeah.
And I'm doing a podcast with some guy I don't know from New Jersey in my 39th year coaching.
Yeah.
Because I'm an early adopter, I've realized that these podcasts are a great way to get the message out.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, you couldn't say it any better. And, I want to make sure, just to shift gears a little bit. I had three tweets of yours that I wanted to go through with you. And these are like more training specific, you know, in terms of, you know, programming and things like that. And, the first one that I wanted to kind of get into with you is, you know, a little related to, you know, being careful with, and this has been kind of the last couple of days has been a big one, which is why I wanted to hit on this. You know, being careful with, you know, guidance from research only, and without prioritizing, excuse me, what actually works with athletes, like in the applied, you know, setting of training. You know, as Stuart McMillan says best, you do not need a research study for logic. I love that quote from him. Your tweet, though, on this, and I'm going to read this out and then kind of let you get into it a little bit, is, quote-unquote, things the research said were true in your lifetime. 1, best way to get strong, 3 sets of 10 reps. 2, best way to lose weight, high-carb, low-fat diet. 3, the best way to get strong, 1 set till failure. 4, best knee rehab, isokinetic isolation. And you said, you know, feel free to add to any of your followers. So I love that tweet because it just kind of highlights some of the stuff that has been around and been proven and quote unquote proven and disproven. And obviously for, you know, people who don't know, some of those things are very much the opposite of what you want to do in those situations. But what is your take on that? And what do you think is the problem with, you know, how people are going about prioritizing research over actual training?
Well, there's problem one is that there are what I would call these evidence-based clowns. That's become a new thing in terms of, I'm an evidence-based guy. And what I think, God forgive me, but most of these evidence-based guys are a bunch of losers in terms of they're guys who aren't good at what they do. And as a result, they're constantly making excuses why they're not good at what they do. And so they spend their whole day poking at everybody else. And you don't have any evidence for that. And it's like an epidemic on Twitter, and particularly as it relates more to physical therapy than as it relates to strength and conditioning. Mm-hmm. My only point is that the research has changed in my lifetime. There were things that we were told were true based on studies that ended up to not be true. And what I want the evidence-based people, the research-based people to understand is that these things have changed. You can't look at the evidence today and say, because of this evidence, you can't do what you believe to be true. And that's what these guys are saying. You can't foam roll because there's no evidence. And my thing is, I think there's a lot of evidence for foam rolling. I just don't have a research study. I have thousands and thousands of people who say they feel better from foam rolling.
Yeah.
And so I look at that and think that's evidence. And their whole thing is, no, it's not evidence because – it wasn't a research study and it wasn't properly designed. And so in effect, what they do is they invalidate all of our experience. and say experience isn't valid. Only things that are proven by the research is valid. And my thing is that I'd rather and I forget who it was, but a coach years ago said research is sports history. The researchers study what we've already done to figure out why we did it. And I believe that.
Yeah. I think there was a Charlie Francis quote close to that. It might have been him basically saying the researchers come in to show why what I do works, basically.
Right. Yeah. And so for all these evidence-based guys, I look at it and think you're 100% wrong.
Yeah.
And I may be 100% wrong too, to be honest. I may end up – I've been very famous for changing my mind. Because when somebody comes along and shows me – core training is the perfect example. All of us were flexion-based people because that was all we knew.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to call – we didn't call it core training. We called it abs.
Yep.
And we did sit-ups and we did crunches. And we did twisting sit-ups and twisting crunches. And then a guy like McGill comes along and says, you know, my research is showing that all of this crunching and flexing may not be good for the spine. Now, the difference for me, I put two and two together. Back pain is a big problem still. We're doing lots of abs because they used to just tell us, just get your abs stronger and everything will be fine. We got our abs a lot stronger and everything wasn't fine. Mm. Our back pain did not disappear. We still had probably the same amount of back pain that we had before. And so then I started looking, well, I'm going to give McGill stuff a try. Based on his research, it made sense. Then I started looking at research things based on rotation, where things like, you know, Shoei Sarman and Porterfield and, you know, James Porterfield and Carl DeRosa saying rotation is not a good idea. The spine doesn't like rotation. And I started looking at that and saying, okay, maybe we've also made a mistake with the rotational things that we're doing. Let's take some of those things out. The difference for us is I took some things out and things got better. I took flexion out, things got better. I took aggressive rotation out, things got better. So I look at that and think, I don't need some guy at University X telling me that that's a good idea. Although it did start with research. It started out with a guy like McGill. It started out with maybe knowledge, but not research. I don't know if people say Shirley Sarman stuff is invalid because she has no research to prove it. And I look and think, she's a 70-year-old physical therapist with legit 40 plus years under her belt treating people. I'm going to listen to what she says.
Yeah.
I don't care if someone says, oh, her theories have never been tested in the laboratory. I look at it and think, I could care less. Makes no difference to me.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with Charlie stuff. I'm a huge Charlie Francis guy.
Yeah.
I mean, there are certain things, as you know, Stuart said, you know, he was talking about logic. You don't need to research. You don't need research for common sense.
Yeah, I think that was a thread. It was actually like a young coach commenting on a thread saying like, well, you know, I forgot what the hell it was. Was that hamstrings? Oh, yeah. It was like, where's the research that sprinting's the best, you know, way to reduce, you know, hamstring injury and build up the post. And it was like, I don't think I really need research to say that. Like, it's just like, it's logic. Like, it's just you sprint and it's, you know, it good mechanics and optimal sprint mechanics have been shown to just reduce likelihood of hamstring injury. I think that was what he came in on that thread. It was over the summer, I remember. But another example too, and I'm going to bring this up because I know, I talk about it all the time and I've seen you, when we've actually had interactions on it as well. The studies from, JB Marin and, I believe Matt Cross with the resisted sprints, and that came out because people were using sleds to get faster, you know, pulling sleds, sprinting with sleds and getting faster and getting good results. They didn't need a study to start doing that. They used it based on, you know, deductive reasoning and figuring out what would work. They saw times got better and they figured, okay, that works. And then a whole nother, you know, group of people came in and said, you know, we're not going to use those because they mess up mechanics and, you know, they're not good to do. So then the study came in to say, okay, what side of this is the right way to go? And now people use that study to say like, hey, this is fine to use the resisted sleds to build speed. And it's actually not only fine, it's optimal and it's good. So I think that's a good example there of like, you know, not putting the cart before the horse, and letting the results speak and then maybe using a study to kind of validate after.
Exactly. It's a perfect example because I wrote an article on sled training, probably early 2000s. And I said, we push heavy sleds. And everybody said, oh, you can't push heavy sleds, but it's, you know, it's going to ruin your stride frequency. It's going to ruin your stride pattern. And I was kind of like, our 40 times are really, really good. We're going to the combine and we're doing great from the heavy sled work that we're doing. So I'm struggling to see that this is not working, even though, again, and there was a very early research study. It was a Greek guy, I forget his name, did the study, and it didn't really look at heavy sled pushing. It only looked at sled running. And so that's the other thing that happens, and this is, I could go on about the research thing forever, but we over extrapolate in areas that we like. So the perfect example I always use is stretching. I can remember someone saying, don't static stretch, it reduces power. And I stopped for a long time. And we just did dynamic warm-up. And the thing that I noticed over time was that our injury rate went up, our overuse injury rate went up, our back pain, our hip pain. And every time I took somebody, because I used to go to physical therapy with these guys all the time, it would almost always be something where the prescription for them to get better would involve stretching. And I can just remember sitting there one day thinking, wait a second. Everybody that I have that's hurt needs to stretch. But the research is telling me not to stretch. I think I'm going to stretch anyway.
Yeah.
So we went back to stretching. And our overuse, I tell people all the time, stretching is not good preparation for exercise. Stretching is good long-term injury prevention strategy. And you've got to look at them as entirely different. If you looked at it as preparation for exercise, it's probably not an ideal tool because there will be some transient loss of power. So if someone said, we're going to run 100 meters today, I'd be like, okay, don't do some prolonged hamstring stretching right before you run.
Or if you do the warm-up after. That's like they don't include that in the study.
Warm-up after because it goes away. It's transient. But the point is I would tell them don't stretch in your lane. Like don't be in your lane doing hamstring stretching because you'll probably pull your hamstring.
Yeah.
But the difference was when you read the studies, and this is what's interesting. So I went back and started reading the studies and they weren't compelling. The loss of power was very, very small, 5 to 7%. So I started looking at that thinking, gee, what's 5% of a 30-inch vertical jump? It's like, that's an inch and a half, right? So we're talking about static stretching, decreasing your vertical jump transiently in a, you know, a sort of test retest setting by 1.5 inches. Mm-hmm. Is that really a big deal? Probably not. And then, like you said, then realizing that it's transient, that if I just go do my dynamic warm-up and come back, I'll be right back at 30. Then you realize it's entirely insignificant.
Yep.
But the people who were anti-stretching advocated for us eliminating stretching based on results of studies like that because they wanted to be right, not because they wanted to be helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
That's the difference that we have to look at now. And there's a lot of those kind of guys. And again, I try to not name names or character assassinate. But there's a lot of guys in our industry that are trying harder to be right and prove a point than they are to be helpful. And as a result, there's one very famous now core. It's kind of I think it might be a meta-analysis kind of thing. And you can read the whole thing, which I did. Looked at every study. But at the conclusion, the authors wrote a conclusion that they wanted to write. And basically that flexion was okay. And that you could still do flexion-based exercise. Even though if you looked at the studies that they reviewed, it was at best split. And I would say it was probably more on the side of anti-flexion than pro-flexion. But
is no one like checking them on that though? Like that's what I don't understand. Like how can they just write a conclusion?
I don't think people take the time. Yeah. And then when you do these same people react very negatively that you're negative and you're bashing them. And I mean, the reality is, and I did, I got in trouble with these guys. Because I came out and said, this isn't true, that they did this, whatever. I think maybe they called it a prospective study. I forget. It was basically a study where they read a lot of studies. And the guys who do these studies, where they read a bunch of other studies, they're agenda-driven people generally. They're trying to prove a point. And a lot of times at the end, they say, well, the evidence didn't show that flexion you know, there wasn't a, you know, a preponderance of the evidence that showed the deflection was bad, whatever it was. But the reality was they came out of it with exactly the way they went into it, because they went into it wanting to be correct. And really good researchers, I mean, if you in the true research world will go in with that sort of null hypothesis idea, this idea that I'm not for or against this, I just need to look at these two variables and figure out which one works. I don't believe there's enough people in the research world that are doing that. I think there's a lot of people in the research world that are simply, they have an idea. They're either for or against something, and that's why they're studying it. And generally, that I think that clouds what they're doing.
Yeah, it's funny. I just opened my phone while we're going back and forth, and the first thing that comes up on my Twitter is a study about one of the negative effects of strength training, and some guy that I respect, I'll send it to you after we're done talking, but because you get a kick out of it, was like, yeah, like, well, the study was done with, you know, sedentary males. I don't know if that's like the best population to use in terms of like trying to prove something for athletes. And it's like, there you go. Case in point to what you were just saying. Like, what are we trying to prove? That something, an agenda you have that you want to say that there are negatives to strength training, or that you actually found something useful to help people? It's just simple.
And then I think go back and look at the guy who did the study and say, is this guy an endurance athlete? Is this someone who has some vested interest
in
strength training not being? Because it's the same thing. I had another argument with a guy, or discussion via social media and via webcast. And he kept saying that, because I'm anti-squatting, he kept saying squatting has been proven in all of these studies to do this. And I said, no, that's not true. I said, all of the studies show that lower body strength as tested by squatting is beneficial. I said, you're crediting the test with the result. I said, you can't, you know, until that study looked at squatting and unilateral squatting, or squatting and, you know, front squatting and back squatting, or until there were more variables, you can't give credit to the test for the result. You can only give credit to the test for being the test. Because his thing was, there's so many studies that show how good squatting is for you. And I said, no, there's a lot of studies that document that lower body strength is beneficial. And they chose the back squat as the test.
Yeah, well, it's like you could have used a trap bar deadlift, you could have used a front squat, you could have done a split squat, you could have done any number of things.
And so you can't attribute that to squatting.
Yeah.
You can only attribute it to lower body strength. And this is what I mean. You can look most of the time and sort out or tease out somebody's agenda.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I'm gonna send you the page when we're done talking. I want your opinion on it. But you mentioned something. It's a really good segue, by the way. You mentioned, you know, is the guy an endurance athlete when he's saying there's some pitfalls to strength training? And it was a great segue to the second tweet that I had. It's just an overcomplication of speed training. Your tweet was basically, want to get faster, run fast. And the reason I said it's a good segue is that one of the many problems in terms of speed training is that it's turned into conditioning. And then obviously, you know, some of the other problems are there's a lot of, you know, gimmicks and, you know, quote unquote agility classes where there's just like an emphasis on, you know, everything but sprinting, it seems like. You know, what are you passionate about in terms of that topic? And I would agree with you 1,000% about, you know, I say sprinting is the number one way to get faster. And I know you would agree with that from what I've seen from you. And obviously we're both really big fans of, you know, running with, you know, resisted sprints and certain loads. So what was your take on that? And what does that mean to you?
Well, that's been probably the biggest, game changer for me. I really get into Tony Holler's stuff the last couple of years.
Yep. Right. And yeah. Genius. I would call him a genius. He's smart.
That there is a cause and effect nature, in the sense that, and I always say to people, if you're doing speed development work, and I don't care, you know, you could be doing, you know, Bosch drills, running with bags over your head or sticks or whatever it is. If you don't know how fast you are, you won't know how fast you got. That's one thing.
Yep.
So timing is essential. But then when we start timing, we realize that timing in and of itself is the most powerful stimulus, because it changes the intent of the exercise.
Yeah.
We used to run a lot of sprints, but we didn't time a lot of sprints. And then the net result was we probably didn't get the changes in horizontal displacement that we wanted. We didn't get faster like I would have liked to have gotten faster. Now that we're timing, our kids are getting crazy fast. And it's strictly based on cause and effect. Hey, run from here to here. Okay? Now that you did it in that much time. Okay? Now try to do it again faster. The thing, and then I could spend the next hour talking about this, but it just makes so much sense. And again, the track influenced people, some of them, oh, you know, you got to do this drill and that drill, and you got to skip, and you got to step over, and you got to, like, we don't do any of that stuff. Or if we do, we call it warm-up. That's our warm-up. We're going to do all the warm-up stuff, then we're going to run sprints. But, and the analogy that I used, I did a lot of talks with this stuff in it this year. I said, if you look at Ben Johnson and Carl Lewis, so if you look at kind of the standard comparison, one guy was perceived as a weightlifter, one guy was perceived as a non-weightlifter. One guy was like steroid guy, loved the weight room. The other guy almost was disdainful of the weight room based on the information that we were getting, right? You know, Ben's Charlie's guy, and it's all about, you know, ground reaction force and strong. He's a 600 squatter. He's a 365 bencher. Carl's longer, lankier, and doesn't ever seem to be posting any sort of weightlifting videos or rep max stuff, any of that stuff, right? But when we get down to the race, they are identical with very little difference between them. You know, you're talking about like hundreds of a second difference. Mm-hmm. But what do they both have in common? They run sprints, right? So we can literally look at two completely, almost diametrically opposed training systems in regard to strength training and look at nearly identical results. But when we look for the common denominator, running sprints. So that's what I say to people now. Velocity, you want velocity-based training? Run sprints. Because bad sprinting is about 8 meters a second. Great weightlifting doesn't hit three, right? You know, people are like, what about tendo? What about this? I don't care about any of that stuff.
Well, yeah, it's physically possible to drive the bar any faster. There's a limit to it because
it's not
you decelerate. Well, yeah, your body's going to just naturally. I talked about this on another episode I had that you literally can't go any faster than whatever. I don't remember off the top of my head what the actual number is, but you decelerate because there's a bar and you're going through extension, and that's just science.
Right. And the fastest recorded, I think, is just under 3 meters a second.
Got it. Okay.
And that's probably like a power snatch or something. Yeah. So, but that's the fastest anybody's gone. That's not 50% of a sprint.
Yeah. That's the best plyometric effect, right?
Right. Neurologically speaking, nothing comes close. And this is where you get into Tony stuff. Why, you know, sprinters always look like weightlifters, whether they weightlift or not. Mm. Then I always say to people, go watch videos of Bolt training. It's horrible, right? I mean, the weight training part, like he does, like you could go on YouTube and just watch, pull up a bunch of Usain Bolt weight training videos. You will not see anything that you like.
Yeah, or even LeBron. I've seen LeBron, like the really ugly, you know, deadlift patterns, and the guy can jump 41 inches and runs like a deer. Like, it's just like.
But Bolt's the fastest guy in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if I look at the fastest, if you want to be the fastest guy in the world, and then you should do leg extensions, leg curls, leg press. These are the things that I see Bolt doing. I would never do those things, right? But the difference is he sprints. Mm. He sprints and he jumps. So I think that's where the biggest – you got to be able to look at this. Well, let's get to that last one because I got to be done here in a couple minutes.
Yeah, no problem. So basically last one, just importance of in-season training. Your tweet basically saying the best way to get stronger is – not to get weaker. In-season training is key. Again, couldn't agree more on that, but I think people undervalue the importance of in-season training, especially young athletes and you know what they prioritize in season in terms of sport over strength training when they're just as important, or if you know strength training is not maybe more important in terms of injury reduction and you know just making sure that you're not like robbing Peter to pay Paul, because when you get back in the off-season, you're going to lose everything you just had. So what's your take on that?
Yeah, I 100% agree. When you look at – and this, again, was statistically driven, not research, but statistically driven. I would look at our guys and think the guys that did the worst job in season in terms of keeping their strength were the guys who over a four-year period were the weakest. And the guys who did the best job keeping their strength were the guys who over a four-year period were the strongest. So I started to look at it. That was where I came up with this idea. Because if we start off season and you've lost 20% of your strength, I now have to allocate X number of weeks to regaining the lost 20%.
Yep.
That now means my time for strength gain is shorter. So if I have 12 weeks in the off season and I need 4 to get your strength back, then I only have 8. If I go into that same 12-week off season with another player who's exactly where he was at the beginning of the year, I now have 12 weeks to get that person stronger. That's just logic and math. And so we just have to be in a situation where we sort of respect logic and math.
Yeah, yeah, couldn't agree. It just, like, that's the number one reason for me to just tell, like, especially I tell the young kids I train and the high school kids, like, if you want to come back here in the offseason, especially the hockey players, you want to come back in the spring and summer and have to spend half the off, like you just said, 20%, half, whatever it is, you know, getting back to where you were when you stopped, be my guest, but just be aware of the consequences of it. And I try to be real with them and honest. And I think you framed it really well there. And the last little part of that I want to ask you is, obviously there's a huge imbalance between the volume of sport work and strength work, at least from what I've seen. Where do you stand on that, overworking athletes in the practice setting and the sports setting, versus time that could be spent on strength training?
One of the things we've done is we've drastically reduced the amount of conditioning that we do, because I feel like, again, when you look logically, these kids get a boatload of low intensity conditioning, mm-hmm, because they practice. If you look at practice is low intensity conditioning. If you look at your heart rate response to practice, you're getting a lot of that, like 60 to 80% kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so for us, we really prioritize. I want the kids I'm working with, I want 2 days of strength training every week. We try to not miss at all. And we don't do a lot of additional conditioning, but we do speed work. So even our guys, like my son and his friends who are in season, and they're in season because they're first year of high school. So they're almost in 2 seasons all the time, the way high school is. Like, they're in lacrosse and hockey 9 months out of the year each. So we just train and sprint, and we do it all the time. We just don't change. And I try to be non-accepting of their excuses. Oh, I'm tired. I'm sore. Yeah, whatever. You'll live.
Yeah, for sure.
And the good thing is with kids, you'll start to build that adaptation where they expect to train year round. That was, you talked about working with the Hitmen and working with Jim Hunt. And what we did when we started the National Development Program in the 90s, that was one of the things I said to Jeff Jackson is, these kids have to lift. They have to lift year round. We can't be in a situation where we have this sort of off-season program where the kids work out. And Jeff was like, nope, it's going to be a development program. We're going to prioritize development. That means we're going to strength train 2 days a week year round. And when you look at the number of kids that came out of that program and went to the National Hockey League, it's staggering, the number of kids that got drafted and went to the NHL. And it was because those kids were made to work year round and taught to work year round from the time they were 15 or 16 years old. It's the time to get them.
Yeah, for sure. I want to thank you for coming on. I know you have to, you go get going. But just real quick, I usually like to just leave my guests, if they wanted to just leave a thought or a parting thought or kind of wrap up, or any messages they wanted to kind of leave with the listeners, and then they got to get going. So, if there's anything.
Well, one, strengthcoach.com. Strengthcoach.com is my website. I'm there literally every day, answering people's questions. If you have stuff that you want to know, it is a membership site you have to join. But I really believe in what we're doing in terms of creating really good dialogue for people in terms of being able to learn about personal training or strength and conditioning. So that would be the one thing I would leave with. And the biggest thing, like we talked about, is continue to educate yourself, continue to work, continue to engage in the process of getting better. Again, you look at somebody like me, I'm approaching year 40, but I'm still doing these things. I'm still learning. I'm still changing. I'm still adapting. So it's a never ending process.
Yeah. Well said. I want to thank you for coming on. I appreciate your time, and I'm excited to get this out. It'll be out in a couple weeks, but thrilled to kind of have done this with you, and I think it was awesome. So thank you.
All right, you're welcome. Thank you. I gotta get going. Gotta go to the store with my wife.
Thank you again. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Muscles and Management Podcast, brought to you by Challenger Strength. I'm your host, Jared DiFilippo, signing off on the show that's changing the way we view training, sports performance, and business.